Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to These Football Times. FA Cup fourth round day is the way we're going. A bit of a no man's land almost with the FA Cup, because it's such a bizarre round where you're still so far from glory, yet you have all the apprehension, all the anxieties, all the tensions of potentially being tipped out of the cup. But you're still a long, long way from Wembley. This is kind of like a war of attrition territory, and for tonight. To look back at FA Cup fourth rounds gone by, we have the wonderful Paul McParlan. Evening, Paul.
Evening, Stephen. Yeah, as I said, off air, I'm looking forward to a chance to go back to the past a bit and relive some better footballing days, because anything that gets away from the present at the moment is absolutely welcomed.
Oh, it's definitely a bit of back to the past rather than back to the future, I think, for these episodes. Glorious nostalgia that they are. And in the opposite side of the screen to me, we have the wonderful Dave Bowler. Dave.
Evening all. From an Albion perspective, 1968. So it's a black and white FA Cup always. Really. Ever since things went colour, it's all been downhill.
Oh, it feels like this has almost been kind of like made to happen. You know, the 68 FA Cup final. Paul, any thoughts on the 68 FA Cup final? I know we're not on the final yet, but you know, West Brom versus Everton, we have the perfect link tonight.
Yeah, well, I think it was the type of match where Everton fans beforehand had a little bit of a concern, because although Everton had won 6-2 at West Brom that season, I think Alan Baller scored 4 goals in that game. We beaten West Brom at Goodison Park. There was just a feeling in those days that it was really hard to beat the same team 3 times in one season. And that's kind of how it turned out on the day, that, you know, it was a very dogged performance by Albion. Jeff asked the winner in extra time. And, it, you know, some days it's just not to be, you know, and that was just one of those days.
Oh, but Dave, yeah, your favourite moment as a West Brom fan, or is there something that usurps this?
It isn't, because, I mean, I will come on to... I will mention in passing 1968 when we come to one of my games, but I don't know, probably that cup run 78, the Cyril Regis, Laurie Cunningham, Brian Robson team beating Nottingham Forest, stopping the treble.
Oh, yeah.
That was a day.
Oh, magnificent. Magnificent. Well, we'll kickstart anyway. We'll kickstart our looks at the fourth round of years gone by. And Paul, bring us to your first choice.
Yeah, so first choice, I've gone back to the turn of the decade, the 69-70 season, which for all sorts of reasons was quite a unique season in English football history. And I'm focused on the fourth round tie between Burnley and Chelsea, which went to a replay. I actually went to the replay. I'll give you the background a little bit later. But setting the context here, so Chelsea team, to the modern-day Chelsea fan or modern-day football fan, the concept of by 1969, Chelsea had yet to win an FA Cup. We test people's credulity a little bit. But they hadn't won the FA Cup. They'd only been in 2 finals before then, 1915, 1967. And this was Dave Sexton in charge now, who picked up kind of the free-flowing glamour side that Tommy Docherty had started off with, but also a bit of discipline into that side as well. And it was also the time that, really, that team was at its peak. I think they finished 3rd in the league that season. And it was one of those seasons where if Chelsea didn't win something that season, you kind of wonder how quickly that team would have fallen apart. Burnley, on the other hand, you know, just after winning the league in the 1960s, they found themselves kind of struggling mid-table. But they had some really good young players coming through, like Dave Thomas, Steve Kindon, Ralph Coates, Martin Dobson. Some really, really good players. So it was set up to be a really good game. First leg of Stamford Bridge. Chelsea were cruising 2-0, seems to be going straight through. And then last 10 minutes, suddenly Martin Dobson gets involved in the game, scores 2 goals, and Burnley get a totally unexpected 2-2-all draw. And it really was kind of a replay that Chelsea didn't want, because it would have involved a long midway trip to Burnley in January, which is never the most hospitable of places. And as it happened, one of my friends at school was a massive Chelsea fan. And he had been planning to... to absent himself from the school premises on the Tuesday afternoon to get a bus up to Burnley from Crosby in Liverpool, and didn't want to go by himself particularly, and asked me if I fancied coming along. Well, who can refuse an offer like that? So the two of us end up making a rather tortuous journey on various buses to get to Turf Moor. And you know, when we got there, it was quite clearly the replay had captivated the town's imagination. There were queues swirling around the outside of the stadium, and it's hard to pitch now these days a replay capturing the imagination of the hometown team in the extent that it did in the 60s, 70s, and no, mainly the 80s. The whole town seemed to be there for that game, basically. And yeah, so we managed to get in. It was a lockout. People were stuck outside the ground. They couldn't get in the days when you just turned up and pay cash on the turnstile. And Burnley went at it from the start. They were determined to, you know, impose themselves on the game. The crowd were behind. The crowd was just so vociferous. And in the first half, after about 30 minutes or so, Ralph Coates, him of the Bobby Charlton hairstyle, unleashed a tremendous howitzer. Burnley were one up, and Chelsea looked totally lost and out of it. And sometimes in cup games, you know, the FA Cup is littered with unlikely heroes, and Chelsea had an unlikely hero in their team. Now, bearing in mind, Chelsea were the glamour boys, you know, the people who spend their company at the weekend with the likes of Hans People, Miss World, and all these trendy wine bars with showbiz stars. But they had one player in their team who wasn't like that, and who was the butt of fans' jokes. As a player called Peter Houseman, who was a real workaholic player who Dave Sexton rated highly, whereas Tommy Doxey hadn't rated at all. And Sexton saw him as a key player. Chelsea fans used to call him Dolly or Mary. They felt he was not masculine enough. He wasn't one of the lads. He shouldn't be in this glamour team. But the rest of the team appreciated what he brought to that side, how he needed this team together, how he kept them focused. And on 70 minutes, when all seemed lost for Chelsea, Houseman suddenly picks up the ball, goes towards the edge of the penalty area, unleashes a venomous shot, 1-1, Chelsea are back in the game against all odds. Goes into extra time. And Houseman does a one-man show in extra time, basically sets up a goal for Tommy Baldwin, scores another goal himself. Chelsea win 3-1. Fantastic win for them. Fantastic performance by Houseman, who was starting to change his opinion among Chelsea supporters about his value to the team. And the tie is quite unique because when Chelsea won the Cup last season, 1970, it was the only game they played outside of London, because all their subsequent Cup ties were all based in London. They played away at QPR, played away at Crystal Palace, played the semi-final against Watford at White Hart Lane, and played the final at Wembley. I know they reposed out of draft, but the final was at Wembley as well. So it was quite a unique set of circumstances there for Chelsea as well. So it opened then the gateway to the European Cup Winners' Cup win the following season, which they wouldn't have had the opportunity to participate in if they hadn't won that tie at Burnley. And so, I think from Chelsea's history point of view, it's a really pivotal moment, because it's when they went from being also-rans, nearly men, to actually lifting a trophy. And as all three of us totally agree at that time, the FA Cup was a major trophy. In some people's eyes, it was more important than the league championship at the time. And suddenly Chelsea had established themselves as a force to be reckoned with and went on to win the Cup Winners' Cup, as I said. But it could so easily have been a different story. It could so easily have been the coming of age for that young Burnley team, who, if they progressed through that round, might have then gone on a cup run themselves. And that team, I mentioned there, Dave Thomas, Jeff Nulty, Martin Dobson, Ralph Coach, Frank Kasper, etc., who later were tagged with the sobriquet of the team of the 70s. They might have just peaked one or two years earlier than they actually did, and maybe haven't fulfilled their potential. So, fascinating game, and just a great example of how the Cup throws up unlikely heroes. And also a great example thing of how important FA Cup replays are and why you'd want to get rid of them. I have absolutely no idea.
Oh, such a game to pivot, really. I mean, you do get those games occasionally, especially kind of like the FA Cup, you know, back then, you know, in the FA Cup's glory days, was those games that just kind of like deflect teams in one direction or another. You know, this is a Chelsea side that, I think, they finished third in the first division.
It did.
End of that season. It wasn't just a case of them, you know, winging it in the FA Cup. There was a certain degree of consistency to them throughout that season. You know, and listening to your description of the replay, you know, it's almost like a prototype of the final, the final replay. You know, I've sat and watched that game, And, you know, Leeds dominate for kind of three quarters of it, but then Chelsea come on strong towards the end of the 90 and then through extra time. You know, there's a kind of, I don't know, a little bit of rope-a-dope almost. You know, you punch yourself out and then we'll come at you, you know. And yeah, it does sound very familiar to the final as well. Dave, that Chelsea side, you know, where does it rank amongst the contemporaries of that era?
I think they were one of the best sides in the country at that stage. And they went on and won the Cup, obviously, that year. Cup Winners' Cup against Real Madrid the following year. So, I mean, that's pretty decent credentials. And I think they're probably one of those teams that's a bit misrepresented as we've gone through it, as the years have gone by. You kind of think of them as, you know, as Paul was saying, there's that King's Road kind of, you know, very flash and swashbuckling and all that kind of thing, but perhaps a bit soft. But I mean, if you can go to Burnley in an FA Cup replay in the middle of January or the start of February, whatever it was by that stage, and win, I mean, there aren't very many more hostile grounds to go even now than Turf Moor. They are very, very partisan support for there. I remember when I very first went with West Brom there as a in the media office. It was 2001. It was March. And I was in the press box, and you have to walk through the main stand to get into the press box. And it's freezing cold. And they'd got all the bins together, and they'd set fire to the burger boxes in the bins in the concourse. So that's the kind of ground that Turf Moor is. And Chelsea went there and won, you know, which, if you're a bunch of soft southerners, that's not really your thing. And I think this game is a perfect example of how you win the Cup. Somewhere along your run in the Cup, you have to find a really big win, and perhaps an unlikely win sometimes. Maybe you're down to 10 men and you still come through it, or it's gone to a hostile place. And I think that was the one for Chelsea. I think winning there, all of a sudden, yeah, you don't hear it so much now, but in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, you always used to hear, oh, our name's on the cup. And I think that result at Turf Moor was one that would make Chelsea feel that way.
Oh, definitely a big stepping stone towards her. Moving on to our next game, Dave, you're going to bring us one from 12 months later.
I am. This is horrendous self-indulgence, I do apologise. 23rd of January 1971, the first game I ever went to, which was the FA Cup. I was 6 and a half at the time. And I think this is what they would refer to in the quality papers as a love letter to the FA Cup. I mean, the FA Cup I was absolutely obsessed with as a kid, absolutely obsessed with it. The first memory that I do have that I can put a date on was 1968 when Albion, not that I saw the cup final, I can't remember, I mean, I'm sure I did, but I can't remember anything. But the following day they brought the cup back into West Brom, and my dad took me into West Brom, which I was on his shoulders, and I've got a little streamer waving with all this stuff. And I'd never seen so many people in my life. I mean, it was four deep down the high street in West Bromwich, and we were waiting and waiting and waiting. And there was some entertainment because about half an hour before the team arrived, some fella staggered out of a pub, walked into the middle of the road, took his trousers down and fell over. It's about the most West Bromwich thing you can have. And then the team came on the bus and they were on the top of the town hall or whatever it was, holding the cup up. And that's the first thing I can remember that I can put a date on. And that's kind of what the FA Cup was. And I remember that 1970 FA Cup final really well, watching that on television. And as a kid in those days, that was all the football you saw. The FA Cup was, and I think England-Scotland probably, were the only live games that you got on television. At six, you couldn't stop up on a Saturday night to watch Match of the Day. There were no video recorders. You couldn't catch any of that. So I think we had Star Soccer on a Sunday afternoon. And that was it. You saw no football. So the FA Cup was absolute front and centre of everything. I'd been pestering my dad for ages to get to a football match, take me to a football match, particularly after the World Cup and all that in the previous summer. So he eventually relented, and a friend of ours got a ticket, and we got a lift to the game. And we sat in the Alfreds Lane stand, and this was the first time I'd ever seen football in colour, because we'd only got black and white TV set. Never seen football in colour. So, you know, you go into the ground and you come up the steps into the stand, and there's this, I don't suppose it was that green actually, because it was January, it would have been all mud. But anyway, yeah, you see all this thing in front of you, and then you look around, and there's all these people with scarves on and there's this noise and all that. And I think we forget as we get older, even, you know, when we take kids to games and stuff, just how small they are and how big everything else is, you know. And this ground was just absolutely bloody enormous. And all these people around and the noise and the smell of onions from the burger place and all of that, it was just, this was, you know, the most intoxicating thing you could ever imagine, you know, being there. And the old Albion Alfreds Lane stand, there was a little shale running track around the ground, but it was only, I don't know, a couple of feet wide. And there was a throw in early on. We were, I don't know, fourth or fifth row. And Colin Suggett came over to take a throw in. And he was like, you know, 6 feet away from me. And there was an Albion player who was 6 feet away from me. This is impossible. So it was just that whole experience. I mean, the game itself was nothing. I mean, you know, nobody will remember that game in any sense at all. Albion scored first we were towards the Birmingham Road end. They scored at the Smethwick end, which of course seemed like about 3 miles away to me. And then inevitably set him up for a lifetime of supporting the Albion. I conceded in the last couple of minutes and lost the replay. And it's been pretty much the same in the FA Cup ever since, actually. But, it was just the whole overwhelming nature of it. But I think, you know, thinking back, the thing was, I didn't just want to go to a football match. I wanted to go to an FA Cup game because the FA Cup was on top of everything else. That was the gravy. Everything else was meat and potatoes. That was the proper stuff on the top. And going to an FA Cup game, it was just, you know, out of this world. And I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why it's not the competition it was in Europe and number of games and teams playing weekend sides. I think another one, though, is the season ticket thing. Because back then in the 70s, people didn't really have season tickets. Or a lot of, if you stood, you generally didn't have a season ticket. You just went, you paid, and that was it. And now, of course, because it's all seater stadiums, everybody's got a season ticket. And you have to pay for the cup game. And it's kind of it seems unfair that you're having to pay to go and see a football match, having paid your money up at the start of the season. I think that's had a big bearing on the FA Cup. But yeah, I mean, that game will live with me considerably more than, I don't know, most of the other games I've ever seen, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, definitely strikes a chord. I mean, my first game, you know, it's that, you know, what's impressionable at that age. It's the greenness of the pitch. It's the just the sheer size of the place. It's being so small next to so many big people in one place. You've never seen so many people in one place at one time. And yeah, there's a kind of sensory overload that just stays with you for life. Almost like it was almost like a frightening experience, that first game of mine, you know, in a way. You know, the things that stayed with me, kind of like, you know. But, you know, yeah. Just brilliant here, Paul. You know that Ipswich side. You know they go on to some pretty special days themselves.
Yeah, they were. It was kind of, you know, Bobby Robson was kind of setting his imprint on that side a little bit as well. And they, you know, they went on to be, you know, arguably one of the major forces of English football in the 70s. And of course, you know, culminated with their FA Cup win against Arsenal in 1978. So, you know, you could say maybe that testing experience back at the Throstles' next at the start of the 70s was the thing that set them on the road, showing that the we mentioned the word resilience before, getting a good away win in the FA Cup to set you up for better things. I mean, just going back to that West Brom team from that era, Dave, I was just writing down some names when you were talking there. I'm hoping most of these were playing for West Brom at that time, but I think there was certainly a different concept of what constitutes a glamour club in those days. And I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, because West Brom had John Osborne in goal, who was a bit of a TV personality from his appearances on Quiz Ball at the time. Yeah, you had Jeff Astle, who was starting to make a bit of a reputation for himself as a goal-scoring forward. You had Bobby Hope, a really good schemer in midfield for West Brom as well. I forgot about Colin Suggers, who I think you bought from Sunderland, who was also a really good prospect. He had the dependable John Wilde in defence there as well. I'm not sure Tony Brown's in that team or not.
Tony Brown was, yeah.
So Bomber Brown's there as well. So yeah, it's a very, very star-studded team in different respects as well. So, you know, And of course, I mean, West Brom at that time were managed by Aaron Ashman, who's kind of a manager who's kind of disappeared off the football radar. Yeah, here's a guy who's won an FA Cup with a first division team. In two different spells, he took Carlisle from the fourth division to the first division. So he's got some, you know, incredible managerial pedigree there as well. And he's one of these people who's never mentioned in the conversation about great managers from the 60s. Yeah, you know, he actually did. He took West Brom to Europe. You know, so that's a really good achievement. And one final point before we move on, you mentioned there, Dave, about, you know, how important the FA Cup was. I always kind of remember, you know, when your team was on an FA Cup run. I say it was the morning of the sixth round or the FA Cup semi-final. You go down to the newsagents in the morning and pick the how they got their special with all the pictures of the previous rounds and all the good luck messages, because it was all part of that atmosphere that the FA Cup engendered at that time, which to the modern-day supporter seems unbelievable, but it was just the way it was.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was the be-all and end-all, wasn't it? And I remember, you know, after that game and when they'd lost the replay, and it was back end of January, whatever. Oh, the season's over now. And that was how people looked at it. You know, I mean, I think Albion probably were, 14th, 13th in the league, not going down, not going to get into one of the European places. That was the end of the season. Although we did have the Leeds United punch-up still to come. So that's a whole other story. That's a whole other problem.
But that was just one of the great things about January, though, wasn't it? We look at South American football, for instance, and how they split their season into two, which seems insane from a European view and perspective. But, you know, it kind of makes sense in a way. And the FA Cup in January kind of gave us a version of that, because no matter how you'd done over those first 4 or 5 months of the season, you know, if your league hopes had already been written off, you know, here you were, blessed with a second bite of the cherry in January. I mean, going back to the West Brom side as well, you know, they reached the League Cup final in 1970 as well. You know, took on Manchester City, that fantastic Joe Mercer side that had, you know, ended the 60s and began the 1970s with such a flourish before hitting that magnificent self-destruct button in that boardroom civil war that split the dugout as well. But yeah, you know, West Brom, you know, they I don't know, that era to win the cup and in 68 and then, you know, still remain relevant. But, you know, it's a quick drop off and down into the second division. But then to come roaring back again in the late 70s. And I'm sure as the series goes on, West Brom will take make another appearance. Yeah, Dave.
It's perfectly possible. They've been on both and they've lost both of them so far in these two podcasts. So we'll have to address the balance.
Well, we'll have to address the balance. Well, my first pick is 1983, and it's Brighton Man City, the Goldstone Ground. And again, we're talking about pivots. This was a game that kind of had it all. You know, Brighton were incredible that day, ran out 4-0 winners. Michael Robinson, former Manchester City player, got a couple of goals in the second half. A wonderful piece of skill by Tony Grealish to set him up for the third. You know, there was an inspired Jimmy Case who opened the scoring with the aid of deflection. But, you know, this was a Brighton side that just went for the jugular. You know, they really just went for it. And against the Manchester City side that boasted seven of the players that had taken part in the FA Cup final in 1981. You know, this was a Manchester City side that had won the first three games of the season. They'd been top of the table before hitting a bit of an inconsistent patch. But even going into this game, they'd only lost one of their previous seven, which was away at Watford, you know, a team that were in their very first season of top flight football, but would finish the season as runners-up. You know, it was no shame to lose at Vicarage Road in 1982-83. And then this amazing capitulation where they fall to a 4-0 defeat that even within that had its slight sliding doors moment when Steve Kinsey at the post early in the second half at 2-0 down, a City goal back in the early exchange of the second half would have potentially made a massively different occasion. But yeah, this was a game, you know, Brighton in winning this went through to the fifth round for the first time since 1960. You know, they were the team with no particular FA Cup pedigree against the team that, you know, had come very, very close to winning it a year and a half earlier. You know, we all look at the 81 FA Cup final and it's Ricky Veer and it's all of that. But that was a Manchester City side that for the you know, had it not been for a deflection in one direction, might have won a very dull and grey 1981 FA Cup final by a goal to nil. You know, Steve McKenzie's wonderful, wonderful goal and the replay that often gets forgotten. But yeah, you know, this was a City side that, you know, impressively hit the self-destruct button, you know, again at this point, because John Bond, you know, resigns within days of this defeat. You know, City are 10th, and then with 17 league games to go, they win only three of them and slide to an ignominious relegation on the final day, in which David Pleat takes to the main road pitch so wonderfully, evocatively as well. Yeah, this was a game that it had it all. City was still, you know, they were in it, you know, until you know, the third goal went in. You know, it sounds mad to say that City were still in it for about an hour and losing 4-0, but you know, this was a wonderful performance by a Brighton side that would go on to the final, but also go on to before relegation themselves. But you know, this was a year in which, you know, that as we've spoken about, that FA Cup fever, you know, really, really kicked in at Brighton. And again, they eventually come so close to winning in that infamous Smith must score, and he didn't. But that day against Manchester City, they were just imperious, absolutely imperious. Paul, your thoughts on the Brighton run of 83?
Yeah, I mean, it was really totally unexpected as well, wasn't it, Stephen? You know, I mean, when the punters, you know, back in January, were picking their four favourite teams to make it to the semis and the final, I'm sure Brighton were not on anybody's radar at the time. And I think that they had a bit of managerial change, hadn't they? So Jimmy Mealy, ex-Liverpool, being promoted, being first team coach to being manager. And he, you know, he was one of the most unlikely characters to be seen in the tabloid papers, because, you know, the story was at the time he was nicknamed Jimmy Dancing Shoes Media, because he wore these fancy white shoes on nights out. And he'd hooked up with some sort of ex-Miss World glamour model type person who he'd met in Rummy's Bar in Southport on a night out. So suddenly he was almost like a Chelsea-type image in charge of Brighton Hove Albion, from the most unlikely-looking playboy I've ever seen in my life, to be honest. You know?
Oh, totally. He looked like an end-of-the-pier comedian, didn't he?
He could
move a football. One of my dad's favourite players, he could move a football around in his playing days. But yeah, he was very much kind of like living and loving the life at that point in time. Yeah.
He was, and somehow, you know, the fact that they got involved in the relegation draw kind of got bypassed, because he came across as such a larger than life personality. And Bors, you know, I think your reference there to the old time Northern comedian, yeah, it's like a music hall character almost, isn't it? You know, going back to Dave, the Lindsay or Arthur asking people. But yeah, he was definitely it just added to the whole strangeness about Brighton at that time. And of course, you know, you had Brighton, mentioned Michael Robinson there, very, very underrated player. You know, I'm sure he'd be although he wasn't a glamour player, I'm sure most managers had the first name on the team sheets every week, because you knew he was going to give absolutely everything. And then combined with that, you had not my favourite person, Steve Foster. I've had lots of reasons like Steve Foster, but I have to say, you know, for that Brighton defence, he was solid, even though he didn't play in the final itself. And there were one or two other good fringe players as well. I mean, Neil Smiley was always quite a good player for Brighton as well, from that era as well. So, it was a real romance tale about the FA Cup, that the most unlikely team with the most unlikely manager somehow got to the final and actually should have won it and really should have left their mark on FA Cup history. You know, and it's also a good example as well. Sometimes in these games, you get one chance to win it, and if you don't take that first chance, come the second match, the stronger team has learned from their mistakes in the first game and will come through and will win the FA Cup. So, you know, history could have been so, so different. You know, for Jimmy Media, he could have ended up as a pilot on Strictly Come Dancing. That could have been an alternative career for him in the future. You never know. But yeah, it really was a fascinating run to the final. And what about these conversations? We thought names of people I'd forgotten about completely. Steve Kinsey, I mean, he was a really, really hot prospect at one time, wasn't he? He seemed to have everything going for him, and then it just never quite happened for him, whether it was the wrong club, the wrong time, the wrong choices, I don't know. But I remember that time. Was he from Merseyside as well, was he, Steve?
I think he was. I think you're right there, Paul. Yeah. Without checking up, rings a bell somewhere at the back of my mind.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, I'm not checking. It was like
Tommy Caton. They picked, Tommy Caton as well. Yeah, and Manchester City did have that habit of picking up players from those, even going back to like Joe Fagan, way back.
And going back to that 1983 Cup final, if anyone's listening to this podcast for the first time, I recommend you check out the podcast with Paul Power last year, because he talked about that 83 Cup final in some detail, and in particular how the City team was just totally bemused when Tommy Hudson decided to leave the wall to intercept that free kick that deflects and goes into the net to make it 1-1 to Tottenham. And once again, it's the example there, City had that one chance to win the cup, they blew it, and then come to replay, they weren't quite good enough to get over the line. But that's a really good choice, that, Steve, because lots of names and players have forgotten about there. A really unlikely team to get to the final. And going back to what Dave's been saying before, that's a great example of the romance of the FA Cup, when you've got an unlikely team with an unlikely manager, with an unlikely collection of players, suddenly, for one-off games, managed to produce an outstanding performance, give the whole town lift as well, put the club on the football map. And, but for Gordon Smith and his better finish, the course of history on the South Coast could have been so, so different.
And Michael Robinson was the man that teed it up for him as well. Michael Robinson was such a hard-working player. He was just, I loved him at Liverpool. He wasn't the greatest Liverpool player in the world, but he never, ever gave anything less than his full commitment to every single game he played. He was just a great personality as well.
Absolutely.
But Dave, helicopters to cup finals, it did take off, obviously, but the concept never take off, never took off.
No, it can't be a good thing to go there. you mentioned end of the peer comedians, and back in sort of 1980, 83, 84, 85, Manchester City were the greatest end of the peer comedians, and I missed that Manchester City. Really missed that.
But that's the big thing about this particular game as well, because it was just so unlikely what Brighton went on to do there, but it was also so unlikely what Manchester City's fate was as well. The three games in, they were being spoken of as potential champions. Even on the day that Bond leaves, he's got them in the top half of the table. He's not a million miles away from European places. And this amazing helter-skelter to relegation with what was a very talented collection of players. It's always just kind of like stood there as a testament to kind of, what can be achieved and what shouldn't be achieved almost.
They had such a fantastic cast of characters over that period, Peter Swales, Malcolm Allison coming back and all of that stuff. And, that was, I'm sure Manchester City supporters listening to this are throwing things at whatever they're listening to it on, but that was, it was endearing to the rest of us that there was always, you could always rely on Manchester City to give you a laugh somewhere. I remember the day that the Saudi Arabian money came in to City, and Joe Corrigan was the goalkeeping coach at the Albion, and I was talking to him, he came in, I said, "Well, Joe, you must be pleased about all this money coming in." And he said, "Is there any club that can fuck up having all that money? It's Manchester City." And sadly, they haven't, so I don't know.
Oh, most definitely. I think what they did is they became a different Manchester City. I think I always remember saying it. I was working in Manchester at the time and said, "Well, look, to succeed, you're just going to have to stop being the Manchester City and be a different Manchester City." And that's how it's sadly gone, or happily gone, depending on which side of the coin you like your football, I suppose. Moving on to our second choices, though, Paul, what have you brought us for choice number two?
Yeah, I've gone for another sliding doors moments again, Steve and Dave. Tuesday's phrase from before, being a bit self-indulgent here, but I've gone for an Everton FA Cup fourth round against Gillingham in 1984. And it's a real, it's one of these games that's kind of goes under the radar a bit in terms of Everton's history, but it's a real sliding doors moment for the club because obviously 2 months previously, Kendall's under pressure. You know, lots of fans want him out. Attendances have really slumped, and then suddenly they get this they get through against Oxford United, courtesy of the Kevin Brock back pass that brings Oxford back to Goodison for replay. They get through the League Cup, go to the semi-final stage. They then win the third round of the FA Cup at Stoke. They win 2-0. And you'd like to think that this sudden wave of optimism and people starting to believe, but nothing could be further from the truth. The week before Everton played Gillingham, the fourth round of the FA Cup, they played Tottenham Hotspur. Now, I know that attendance was in decline generally in the 1980s, but the attendance that game is 18,000 for Everton against Tottenham in the first division game. It just shows how much, the Everton fans were just waiting to be convinced that it wasn't yet another false dawn. They needed some more stern evidence. And so the cup tie against Gillingham, only attracted 22,000. As I recall, Gillingham had a sizable contingent support as well. It finished 0-0, and really, Gillingham should have won. They hit the bar, they hit the post, Southall made a great save, and they were just the better team on the day. And if they'd won that game, then Everton don't win the cup, then they don't go to the Cup Winners' Cup, maybe the 84-85 team doesn't come together. There's lots of things that kind of hinge on this cup run to take the club forward to their 2 or 3 years of outstanding success and league titles. So it's a really, really close game, and most Everton fans come out the stadium, with the viewpoint, I told you we weren't any better. I told you it was going to end. We're going to get murdered down at Gillingham. And I think most Everton fans were quite apprehensive about the replay, in particular because Gillingham had a young forward called Tony Cascarino, who looked really, really good at the time and was actually causing a real threat to Everton's back four. So we go to the replay, and just before the game, Howard Kendall calls Andy Gray over and just casually mentions to him that he's going to make a change today and he's not playing him. At which point, Andy Gray almost chokes on his steak. He's on the point of throttling Howard Kendall. He's about to walk out of the ground and make his own way back to Liverpool. He can't believe he's being dropped. This never happened to him before. He's only been at the club 3 months. He thinks he's made a big impact. He can't believe Kendall doesn't see him in the light that he sees himself. And he says in his autobiography, Shades of Grey, he was on the verge of opening the door to leave the restaurant to get home by himself, and something just stopped him. And he said that's most unlike him, because he's the most irrational person he can be at times. He never thinks things through, but something just, a voice in his head said, hang on, give this a moment, don't do anything rash. So he stays, and he goes onto the substitutes bench. Once again, the second leg, Gillingham are the better team. Neville Southall, man of the match performance, pulls off some outstanding saves and then goes into extra time. And Tony Cascarino is through one-on-one with Neville Southall, and everyone thinks that's it. He's going to score. He's certain to score. Now, I don't know if you've ever read Tony Cascarino's autobiography, but he talks in detail about that moment in time because he was a player who, unknown to the Everton team, was full of self-doubt. And he said as he's approaching, he can see the goal. He can see Southall. And all he hears is this voice and says, hey, you're going to miss this. You're going to mess this up. You haven't got the goals to do this. You're going to bottle it. And he almost talked himself out of scoring and hit the ball straight to Southall. And Everton hang on for the 0-0 draw. Consequences, Haber Kendall next day says to Andy Gray, you're playing next game. I made a mistake. I'm sorry. I hold my hands up. Gray comes back for the second replay, which I think is Everton lost the toss. The coin was back at the pre-first stadium in Gillingham again. And mentioned there before, you get your opportunity if you're a lower ranked team to win these games if you don't take them. And Gillingham had two chances to take them and they didn't. Come the third game, basically the first division superiority, fitness, skill, toad. Everton stroll onto a 3-0 victory. Sheedy scores two. He scores one. Gray has a role in all three goals. After the game, Kendall seeks him out, says, you're my man last day, Andy. I was really made a bad mistake dropping you. You're my first choice for the rest of the season. And given the influence that Gray went on to have over the following season, 84-85 season, when they won the league in the Cup Winners' Cup, it was one of those sliding door moments, because if Gray had walked out the door, and Kendall was known for being quite firm on internal discipline, he'd probably be on his way out. And once again, the course of Everton's history could have been so much different. And in terms of Tony Cascarino, if he'd taken any of those chances in the first two games, then Everton's Cup run, 83-84, stops, and Gillingham go on to the next round of the FA Cup as well. So, to me, it's one of those pivotal games in Everton's kind of period at that time. And once again, shows the massive importance of the FA Cup, because suddenly, you mentioned the start of this season, the fourth round. You're on the road to Wembley, but you've got a long way to go yet. Suddenly, you're in the fifth round. Suddenly, you're down to 16 teams. Suddenly, you can see the Twin Towers. Suddenly, optimism sweeps the club. Suddenly, fans start to believe that maybe we are on something here, that maybe there is a bit of a cup run developing. And then things start to gather momentum from then. So, yeah, it's just a fascinating period in Everton's history. And I mentioned before about the self-doubt still, the Everton fans at the time. After the first replay at Gillingham, Everton had a home game in between the two replays against North County, which attracted a crowd of 13,000. I mean, 13,000 for except North County on top box office attraction. But even so, 13,000 for a first division game, it's just unbelievably. So I think coming through those games with Gillingham was hugely, hugely pivotal, and Everton managed to progress to the team they became for the next three seasons. And some nightmares about that. Gillingham hit the crossbar in the last minute to go to St Paul. I'm still convinced it's going to go in.
definitely one of those kind of like sliding doors moments. I mean, another player that was in that Gillingham side as well, Steve Bruce was in there as well. Cascarino up front missing the chances, but Steve Bruce stopping, helping keep Everton at bay at least until the second replay. You know, Dave, that Everton side, they bounced on through this to victory. That fourth round of the FA Cup is a bit of an odd one. It's almost kind of like the, I don't know, if the FA Cup rounds make up the sum total of a band, it's the basis really, isn't it? It's an important role, but it's not the most kind of like glamorous one. But because it's the end of January, the weather's still miserable, the pitches are awful. I think by the time you, like Paul said, you get into the fifth round, you feel like you kind of like start to get somewhere. But even then, it's the next step beyond that to the quarterfinals, where the weather's started to look a bit better, the sun's shining, there's only a few of you left in the cup. It suddenly feels like a completely different landscape. For Everton, this was just a massive result, really. The third time of asking, but a massive, massive result.
I was looking at it on YouTube earlier today, and there's a bit there where it's got the three games all stuck together. And the first game, Steve Bruce should have had a hat-trick at Goodison. I mean, he had three headers from corners that should have gone in. But looking at the other two games, my God, what a goalkeeper Neville Southall was. I mean, unreal. Some of the saves that he made in that game, I mean, they should have all got together and just given him all the medals at the end of the competition, because that was a goalkeeping performance for the ages over the two games, just absolutely sensational. But I think one of the great things about that cup tie, and as Paul was saying earlier about replays, it's that intensity of that battle. It was first division against third division, wasn't it? But that battle raged over 10 days. They played the Saturday. They played the replay on the Tuesday or the Wednesday, whatever it was. Tossed a coin, went back to Gillingham again the following Tuesday or Wednesday. And it's all compressed in that thing. And it becomes a saga. It becomes an epic. It has a bigger story. It pulls everything together. And you can't get that in a cup tie where you play 90 minutes. You go through the motions for 30 and then you have penalties. It doesn't have the same impact. Those things don't go down the ages in the same way. But there'll be Gillingham supporters who are still talking about that game, and clearly there are Everton supporters who are still talking about the importance of that game. And that is the FA Cup. I know it's now impossible with the way the fixture list is and the Champions League and the Europa League and all that stuff. But it seems to me that we're losing something really, really important for 84 of the league clubs and all the non-league clubs as well, for the sake of looking after 7 or 8 teams that play in Europe. And, I understand the importance of having an English team winning a European trophy, and I understand the importance of the money and all of that. But to me, it feels like we're sacrificing a hell of a lot for a very small number of people and a very small number of football clubs. And that's a real shame. And I can't see a way around it. I can't see how you now fix that within the context of the modern season, unless perhaps you got rid of the League Cup and you started the FA Cup earlier in the season. But then that wouldn't be right either. Because, you know, you couldn't have the third round of the FA Cup in September. I mean, it would be horrendous. So, I think it's just something that we have to accept as gone. But games like this, the three-game epic, and a few years earlier, there'd been that Arsenal-Sheffield Wednesday game, and then they went to about six matches or something. Those were, those are iconic moments in the history of those football clubs. And I just think it's one of those things, just as Johnny Mitchell said, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. And I think we'll miss that in the years to come. I think we'll really miss it.
It was such a big part of the identity of the competition. There was a game that I came very close to picking for this one, which was the Arsenal-Leeds Odyssey in 1991, the last season in which multiple replays were allowed. It went to four games, and they weren't the most magnificent games, but there was an increased tension throughout each game as it went along, because the stakes just got higher with each game. One of my formative standout memories of football was Liverpool. It's the semi-finals, but the 1980 semi-finals, when we went to four games against Arsenal, and it just got increased. The stakes just got higher because you'd invested so much time and energy into these fixtures, and the prize was huge. But yeah, for Everton, this game was just such a massive one. One of those great pivot points of football. Moving on to our next choice of Dave's. Dave, what have you brought us?
1978, Stoke City, Blyth Spartans. I mean, you're kind of right about the fourth round. It is sort of the ugly sister of the FA Cup. There doesn't seem to be that much that goes on. I mean, the great giant killings don't really happen in the fourth round. It's generally a third round, and maybe, as we'll see later on in the series, you'll get one or two in the fifth or the sixth. But this is an FA Cup classic because it's got all the bits to it, really. I mean, Stoke had been relegated the previous year to the second division, but they've got a proper side. I mean, Alex Lindsay, who'd won the cup with Liverpool 1974, Edward Kendall was there, Alan Bloor, who played hundreds of games for Stoke, Terry Conroy, young Garth Crooks with a different voice. Yeah, they were a decent team still, fallen on hard times a bit. George Easton had just been sacked before the game. And then they came up against Blyth Spartans. And again, that's just one of the great things about the FA Cup. A team called Blyth Spartans. That's just the whole ethos of what the FA Cup is, that you can have a team called Blyth Spartans playing in it. And I was looking it up earlier, and to get to play Stoke in the fourth round, they'd beaten Shildon, they'd beaten Crooktown, they'd beaten Consett, they'd beaten Bishop Auckland, Burscough, Chesterfield and Enfield. So they'd won seven games just to get to the fourth round of the Cup, if Stoke had won seven games, they'd have won the Cup and been in Europe. So, it's an epic. And again, the whole Blyth Spartan support was mobilised. And for the game that was supposed to take place the 28th of January, they'd got 52 coaches of supporters coming down for the game. They set off in a snowstorm, got to Stoke, found that the game had been called off, all went back home. So then you come again on the Wednesday night. By the time that had happened, the draw for the fifth round had been made, and the winners of Stoke City versus Blyth Spartans will play the winners of Wrexham versus Newcastle United. So obviously for the Blyth players, this is some big deal. They all get ready to come down, get ready to go, and the game gets called off again at 11 a.m. So now they have to play the following Monday, and finally the game actually does take place, and there's a thousand fans who've managed to travel down. And I know Paul likes a nice green shirt. They've got a special new kit, newly acquired Buchter shirts, apparently, for this, with a completely green body with white sleeves. And Stoke, bizarrely, had to play in their away kit because the referee wouldn't allow both teams to wear white shorts and socks. So there was a clash. 12 minutes in, Blyth 1-0 up, Terry Johnson scores. And they played pretty well through the first half. Got to half time. Okay. Onslaught from Stoke at the old Victoria ground, which again was another one of those bare pits of a ground back in the day. Viv Busby scored for Stoke after 57 minutes. 2 minutes later, Garth Crooks makes it 2-1. And at that point, okay, Stoke are going to come on and they're going to win this, and the class will tell and all that sort of stuff. But late on, Alan Shoulder, who out of this cup run got a move to Newcastle United in the finish. He hits the post and Steve Carney follows up to equalise. So now they're thinking, great, we can have a load of money at home for the replay. Except with about half a minute to go, there's a flick on into the box. Terry Johnson, who played for Brentford apparently before, he appears from nowhere, lashes it into the back of the net, and they've won the game. Blythe Spartans have won the game. So they're all celebrating. They're all thinking, oh, this is fantastic. Through to the next round. Newcastle have been playing the same night against third division Wrexham. And Alan Shoulder, I was just reading it earlier today, he said, I went in the shower and we were all celebrating. We're having a fantastic time thinking about the next round. And then somebody comes into the dressing room and says, Newcastle just lost 4-1 at Wrexham. I said, we were all depressed for about 10 minutes before we could muster up anything, you know, the energy to be enthused again. But, I mean, again, this is brilliant FA Cup stuff. The players all got new boots as a bonus. And a local Blythe furniture store offered all the players £400 worth of free bedroom furniture as a reward for winning the cup tie. They all barreled down to the factory and picked out what they wanted, you know, vanity unit or chest of drawers or a mattress or something. That's what the FA Cup's all about, isn't it? You get a free chest of drawers. That's the stuff.
Oh, wonderful stuff. Yeah, it's that type of stuff, and the transfer of players for a full set of tracksuits and stuff like that. That's what you want to hear about. This is the stuff that we've come to do this podcast for, most definitely. I mean, poor Blythe Spartans, you know, had it been Newcastle that they'd have faced, that would have been one of the Northeast most fantastic moments of football, surely. I mean, and again, a team similar to Newcastle, you know, the befallen relegation, they were dotting around the second division and doing some water treading as well, just like Stoke were. You know, surely, you know, could Lightning have struck twice had it been the great derby match?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating to speculate what the outcome of that might have been, Steve, because, yeah, you know, and given Newcastle's pretty poor track record against non-league opposition, I think Bedford Town had beaten them in the early 60s, 2-1 at St James's Park. And, of course, Hereford United were soon to lead them off on Newcastle as well. So they did have the best of their records against non-league teams. So, yeah, it would be an absolutely fascinating contest. And what an experience that would have been for the Blythe players as well, and for the town of Blythe as well. And that, yeah, I mean, listen to, you know, to Dave's recount of that as well. You know, you think you really captured well, the frustration of the ties being postponed, making the journey. You know, and for the first game, they had over 50 coaches of fans. By the time that it gets played, they're down to about 1,000 fans. And little things like that make a massive difference to the atmosphere and possibly, you know, to the outcome of the game as well. For us who did this in this case, and I mean, that name Blythe Spartans, there's certain names that conjure up FA Cup giant killers. You know, and Blythe Spartans, one of those names, you just think straight away, FA Cup giant killers. And I was just trying to think of other names that I've grown up with. Leatherhead, we had a guy called Chris Kelly, who was called the Leatherhead Lip. He would always be mouthing off before games what Invernham would score against first division teams. Well, I think got a move to QPR at one stage. Yeovil Town, with another famous non-league team as well. Altrincham, even Wigan Athletic when they were a non-league team as well. Bedford, who I mentioned before. So there were certain names that as a kid growing up, you thought straight away, giant killing teams. You want to avoid these in the FA Cup. And yeah, I mean, the furniture story is brilliant, and it's good the way kind of the whole town comes together. And I think you mentioned at the start of the day about, you know, where the magic of the FA Cup lives on, and I think it still lives on in, you know, small towns, suburbs of non-league teams. And I've encountered like a modern example. You know, when I live in Crosby, my local non-league team's Marine. Now, when they had the second round FA Cup game against Waterloo and Havant, and it was during lockdown, it was during COVID, so, you know, there's no fans in the stadium. But as soon as the final whistle went, you know, me and my wife and son went down to see if anything was going on at the ground, so, and we got there, and there's about 1,000 people outside the stadium, setting smoke bombs, blocking traffic, singing, dancing, popping champagne corks, and it was just absolute chaos and bedlam, and I've never seen anything like it. You always for the team to come out, they mobbed the players as they came out, and there was no police presence at all to be seen at a time when we were supposedly in lockdown. And then after 20 minutes, about two police cars turned up, and one of the police stopped me. He said, well, what's going on here, mate? I said, well, you know, it's the FA Cup. Everyone's going, you know, we don't make the third round of the FA Cup that often. It's a big day for the town of Crosby. He goes, yeah, well, we knew the game was in Crosby, but we thought everyone in Crosby would be obeying lockdown rules or wouldn't come out to get involved in the football. I said, how long have you worked in Liverpool for, mate? You know, do you know anything about football passion in this city? You know, so and it just goes to show that, you know, the passion's still there, particularly at non-league level. It brings the town together. It raises the profile of the town. And, you know, even, I mean, that game's 50 years ago, isn't it, Dave? You know, even now the name Blythe Spartans conjures up memories of those of us who lived through those kind of, you know, they were a really, really strong non-league team. And, of course, these days, when they talk about non-league shocks, you know, like it was a shock Wrexham beating Coventry 4-1. Well, I say it wasn't that much of a shock because Wrexham put on a larger budget than Coventry. They're full-time professional teams. And I think these days, the idea of a non-league team from the National League beating a league club is not that much of a shock because financial-wise, there's probably a little difference between them. I think even National League North and South, there are a number of clubs who have now gone full-time. So the concept of an FA Cup shock, it doesn't quite have the same resonance now as what it did in the 60s and 70s, where most of the people there would be going back to work on the Monday morning and the variety of different jobs as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, to me, non-league teams make the FA Cup. They absolutely do. You're watching their progress. You're trying to see who they get in the draw. You're trying to how far they can get. And it's just great that, you know, each... when you embark upon that cup, when you have your 15 minutes of fame, as Andy Warhol would say, you bring media attention to your part of the country, and for certain players, it could be a launch pad to possibly, you know, being picked up by a lead team and going on to have a successful career, as you indicated there in the case of Alan Shoulder.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, these are the stories that, you know, that the FA Cup has been, you know, it's reputation, you know, it's standard. We're built on another. The commentator will always call it the great leveler. You know, it's the, you know, the state of the pitch. It's the passion of the supporters. It's the nerve of the constitution of the players who should win the game. You know, they've got their reputation on the line. You know, the smaller club have got nothing to lose. Apart, you know, you have to lose the match, but, you know, everyone's expecting them to do so. So, you know, even that's never going to be a defeat. But yeah, I grew up with Blythe Spartans being this name of significance, and, you know, what a brilliant name, you know, that they are. You know, it's, you know, still to this day, you know, you can't hear a name like Blythe Spartans and not break out into a big massive smile.
Indeed.
Well, moving on to our last choice of the night, Aston Villa Liverpool 1988. You know, a game that always kind of, like, you know, even now, you know, the game's there, available on YouTube in full. You know, ITV showed it live that day, and, you know, Villa had been relegated the previous season, you know, in the infamous year in which Billy McNeil took both Manchester City and Aston Villa down in one fell swoop. And Graham Taylor had taken over that summer. He dropped down a division in leaving Watford, you know, felt he'd done all he could with them. Wanted a new challenge, you know, back to his part of the world almost, took on the Aston Villa job. And this was the team that were on the up again. You know, they were still a team that boasted two European Cup winners, three future England internationals, you know, Martin Keown and Tony Daly amongst them. You know, Alan McAnally scoring goals up front for them. They were the pace setters in the second division against the Liverpool side, who had yet to lose a league game that season. Their only reversal had been in the League Cup against Everton earlier in the season. But Liverpool went into it with a couple of injuries. They'd lost Gary Gillespie, they'd lost Ronnie Whelan. In had come Gary Ablett and Nigel Spatman. You know, it destabilised the side. Steve Nicol played as an emergency central defender, with Ablett filling in at left back. And a lot of people felt that there was you know, a chance for Villa. You know, especially on home territory, their tails were up. You know, one of the form teams in the country, albeit from the second division, and it was like a huge occasion. You know, massive packed out stadium as well. You know, passionate support. You know, a buzzing away end, and, you know, this was a team, Aston Villa, who were still only what 6 years on from having, not even quite 6 years on from having won the European Cup. So it was an amazing game. It was also season. Liverpool had that polarizing kind of silvery grey away kit that had been introduced that season, but they were back into wearing white because of Aston Villa's magnificent, you know, Danish Dynamite inspired claret and blue version of that Mexico 86 kit of Denmark's. I think it was one of those games that just had everything. There was a whole 10 that was, it's still in its glory as well. And me as a, I don't know, impressionable 14-year-old that I'd been at the time. I think it's that day that cemented my soft spot for Villa Park as being one of my favourite away trips, as well as the neighbours. I think it's just a brilliant part of the world for going watching football as an away supporter. Barnes and Beardsley, ended up settling the game, with a couple of really wonderfully taken goals. And I think it was just one of those, great games that it was just one of these sartorially elegant moments of football. And I think the fact that so many people really did think that Villa were in with a chance of turning over this rampant Liverpool side was a true testament to Graham Taylor and how he was rejuvenating a side that had looked so stale just a short few months earlier. Dave, thoughts on Graham Taylor and that Aston Villa side?
It's always difficult with Graham Taylor, isn't it? Because, I mean, everything is so seen through the lens of that, the documentary and turnips and, failure with England and stuff. I mean, it's such a shame because, he was a proper football man. I mean, he absolutely loved football and he loved the FA Cup as well. I mean, I interviewed him once for Watford's programme about the FA Cup and, he couldn't have been more enthusiastic about the competition. He just absolutely loved it and would never want to play a weakened side in there. He would always want to win the FA Cup and win games in the FA Cup. And, he got Villa turned around in no time at all. As you say, they'd won the European Cup 82. So what, you're talking 6 years on from that. And to have been relegated so soon after winning the European Cup, that place was on the floor at that stage. And he turned it around, within a couple of years they got promoted and they were in the running for the title and all that sort of stuff. He was a really clever football manager. In club level, his record was outstanding, except at Wolves, fortunately. I think he's unfairly maligned, but he always knew how to get a team going. And people say, it was one-dimensional and it was just a lump forward and it was... But I'm not sure it was always as straightforward as that. I mean, he played with wingers. Okay, they were direct and they were quick. But, I watch a lot of football now and they pass it out from the back and they pass it out from the back and they pass it out from the back and nothing happens. If you're Manchester City, you can pass it out from the back. If you're a normal club in the Championship, you probably can't pass it out from the back and you get yourself into trouble and then somebody lumps it in 60 yards forward anyway after you've had 9 passes between your centre arms. I can't see the point. So, I think Graham Taylor understood how you were effective, how you built an effective football team. But, you saying that people thought that Villa might win. I remember the late 70s and all of the 1980s and I never ever thought anybody would beat Liverpool. Certainly not whenever we played them, because it was just you'll play really, really well in the end, Liverpool win. And that was how it was.
Oh, they were good times. They were good times. obviously, from my perspective. But Paul, that Aston Villa side, what's quite amazing about this game and always strikes me, again, we talk about these kind of like pivots and sliding doors and all that type of stuff, but just what happened to that Villa side in being relegated in 86, 87, and then looking at, an entertaining side in 87, 88 in winning promotion back to the first division. It's the fact that Taylor turns them into title contenders by 89, 90, having flirted with relegation again in 88, 89, and then ironically going toe-to-toe with Liverpool in 88, 89, 90. I'm always of the mind that if Liverpool had got over the line against Arsenal in 89, that Villa would have won the title in 89-90. Liverpool won 89-90 as a riposte to what happened at the end of 88-89. And there was a little bit of autopilot almost. And it's those knock-on effects almost. So, Taylor, he's just got that You know, the fact that that major trophy eluded him, to have lost the 84 Cup final, to have come, you know, within, you know, they were still in with a really good chance of winning that league title as the end of, you know, certainly by mid-April. With four or five games to go, they were literally just a point behind Liverpool, although they'd played a game more. You know, they were still in with a shout. The right man, the right opportunities, just slightly at the wrong time, almost.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I think as both you and David said there, Stephen, I think Graham Taylor's definitely ripe for a revisiting of his reputation, because I think you go back to the start of his career when he picked up a moribund Lincoln City team. I think when he took them up from fourth division, he got a record point total in his first season there. If I recall correctly as well, though, when Elton John approached Don Revie to take the Watford job, and Revie turned them down, and he then asked Revie, who would you recommend to take the job? And allegedly, Don Revie recommended Graham Taylor as the man to take the Watford job. So Elton John listened to Revie's advice, and then Graham Taylor came on and took the job. And I think that his record at Watford, it's just fantastic. For a small town team into, because there was one season, wasn't there, Stephen, when they finished up running to Liverpool in the early 80s as well?
82, to the first season that they'd been up. Yeah, the very first season they finished runners up.
You weren't a serious threat, but they were always in second, weren't they?
They were totally second. Yeah, it was a year Liverpool massively run away with it that year. But Watford played some good football. Going back to what Dave was saying about the football and how Taylor was maligned for his style and stuff like that. What Taylor did is that he would have a rigidity to his formation. This 4-4-2 or 4-2-4 almost at times, but it could be wonderfully attacking. Now, you don't have a team with John Barnes going down one flank and Nigel Callaghan down the other without it having some kind of style and purpose, to it. They did play some fantastic football. They I can always remember them kind of like being involved in games that ended in high scores. I think there was like a mad 7-4 against Birmingham or Southampton that always stuck in the mind. I remember listening to it on the radio and not being able to kind of like break away from it to do my own work, because there was like a goal virtually every 3.5 minutes and stuff like that. And I mean, even going back to kind of like when Joe Fagan, departed as Liverpool manager, there was kind of like a serious consideration at Anfield if they were going to go for an outside appointment. Then to break the tradition, then Graham Taylor was one of those that was on the radar at Anfield at that time, which speaks volumes for him, and his managerial abilities. I do think he'd have got there, to win a major competition at some point. Had the England job not come up and he'd have remained at Villa Park, I do think it would have come to him eventually.
I wouldn't argue with that, Stephen. I think as well, you made the point there about Watford were quite entertaining at times, because I remember in the mid-80s going to Watford to see Everton play Watford twice. The first time we drew 4-4, the second time we beat them 5-4. So, yeah, you're right, they were an entertaining team to watch. I think what's often overlooked about Graham Taylor as well was he was prepared to change as the team progressed. So the players he used to get him into the first division, like George Riley, Ross Jenkins, people like that, who we realised were going to be quite limited in the top division, then we played by likes of Morris Johnson, John Barnes, and gets a chance. He did adapt as well. And I just think, Dave, you mentioned before about Villa being in the doldrums in the mid-80s. Steve, you mentioned the relegation in 87. And to come into a club that basically is reaping of decline, failure, the empire's fallen, and to come in and pick them up and quickly get them back into the top flight, really takes some doing. That does take it. That's a huge bit of huge managerial challenge, and shows the planning, the structure. Because even the modern footballer likes structure. They like to know, go on the pitch, this is what I'd like you to do, this is your role, stick to that, you'll be okay. And maybe for Taylor, the England job came at the wrong time. As you say, Steve, maybe if you stayed with Villa. Because I think Ron Atkinson took that team to be runners up in the first season of the Premier League. I don't know, maybe a different outcome there if Graham Taylor's there. Maybe, slide doors again, Villa win the league that season, United don't, Ferguson's under more pressure again, the ball panics, and Michael Knighton takes over, and who knows where we end up, but it's just interesting to speculate on how these things may pan out. But I definitely think Graham Taylor's a wife review missing. And I totally agree with you about Villa Park, one of the absolute meccas of football, fabulous stage. I mean, you may not agree, Dave, but as an away fan, it is a superb arena. And just it just seeps of history and football and tradition.
No, I'll give you that one. That's fine.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, the fourth round of the FA Cup, it's been we've branded it the Ugly Duckling. It's the basest of the band, but you know it's still offered some magnificent iconography of the FA Cup, you know, of its glory days, and coming up, you know, there'll be a collection of us back to discuss the fifth round in a few weeks' time. Dave, thanks very much for taking part. Your input again, just wonderful.
It's been a pleasure to go down memory lane and realise quite how old I am.
Oh, great stuff! And Paul, you know, fantastic as always. You know, your recollections of that 84 Everton game as well, or games. Just brilliant insight.
No, thanks, Steve. I mean, thanks for having on the show again. Really enjoyed this trip down memory lane. Great listening to you and Dave talking about the players, the games, you know, names I've forgotten about, managers I've forgotten about, clubs I've forgotten about, and just bring them all back again to certainly a time, I'm sure Dave would agree, when the FA Cup was the competition, and it's such a shame that it no longer is.
Absolutely.
A bittersweet end, we'll call that there. But yeah, thank you to listening to the Love Podcast via These Football Times, and we will see you again very soon. Goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.